conservatism, Christian fundamentalism, liberalism, and paternalism. Bill Cosby and Bill Clinton, not all right, but all wrong. Let's begin by talking about the two bills, Cosby and Clinton. As Michael Eric Dyson pointed out in an interview a year ago, and spelled out more fully in his book, is Bill Cosby right, or has the black middle class lost its mind? Cosby has been on a, what Dyson termed, a blame the poor tour. And more recently, Cosby seized on the occasion of his commencement speech at Spelman College to continue his attacks on poor black people locked in the ghettos of the inner cities. Cosby has ripped into them for the actions of some in the context of conditions imposed on them, but he has not acknowledged or given any real weight to those conditions and the forces that have imposed them. And in fact, Cosby has belittled and ridiculed recognition of those conditions and those forces. At the same time, Cosby has demeaned and denigrated what are in reality some of the very positive qualities of the masses of black people, including their basic sense, if not yet a fully developed understanding, of the fact that not they, but in some way their oppressors, are responsible for their conditions. And on a perhaps somewhat lighter but still important note, such things as the creativity of black people, in particular black mothers, in the naming of their children, which seems to infuriate Bill Cosby because it is not respectable enough and does not conform to what are, in fact, racist and elitist standards of refinement. Let's begin with the latter aspect first, creative naming. Now, given my love for basketball, I can't help but starting with this example. Back about 20 years ago, there was a basketball player, a black basketball player playing for Memphis State University, who was named Baskerville Holmes. And having read some Sherlock Holmes stories and knowing the story of the Hounds of Baskerville, I couldn't help admire the creativity of the parents who had given him this name, Baskerville Holmes. Obviously, his last name was given originally by the slave owners, but combining Baskerville with that I thought was rather creative. And every time I watched him play, I couldn't help smiling at the creativity that had gone into naming him. But Bill Cosby's on a rant about Shamiqua and Shaliqua and all these other names like this, which are, in fact, as I said, an expression of creativity. And, okay, so sometimes, as in all art forms, some of it is better than others. And sometimes the names kind of fall flat or don't really resonate or don't really sound that good, at least to my ear. But so what? That's true in any art form you might choose to examine. And that's what this is. These are mothers taking creativity to try to give some identity to their kids, which the whole system works to stamp out of them. And Bill Cosby's on a rant because, as I said, this is not respectable enough and doesn't conform to what are objectively racist and elitist standards of refinement. And, you know, Michael Eric Dyson points out, well, you know, what about Muhammad Ali? All the authorities, in particular the white authorities in the country, jumped up and down when Muhammad Ali insisted on taking that name. Now, you know, that's part of an Islamic religion, so it's not exactly, you know, something that I'm enamored of as such. But in the context of the times, it was an act of defiance. And it was, for those of you who don't remember and those of you who do, it's important to recall that when he took that name, because it was an act of defiance and all the things that were bound up with it at the time, it was a subject of extreme and intense criticism and harassment. There were sports announcers who refused to call him Muhammad Ali and continued to call him Cassius Clay, even though they had no trouble calling movie actors by names that are by no means their real names. For example, Brent Musburger, who still announces sports, refused for long, long years to call Muhammad Ali Muhammad Ali as part of his general reactionary ranting and idiocy. If we had had Bill Cosby acting then as he's acting now, using whatever fame and notoriety and money he's been able to accumulate to attack and denounce the mass of people, if he'd been acting then as he's acting now, he would have been on the side with Brent Musburger, ranting and raving about why didn't Muhammad Ali stay with a long distinguished name like Cassius Clay, never mind that it was the name of a slave-owning family. I can't help here interjecting another little personal note that I found amusing when I was first in, had gone to France. I did an interview by long distance, obviously, with Pablo Guzman, who, when he was in the Young Lords Party and then the Puerto Rican Revolutionary Workers Organization, went by the name of Yoruba. And before the segment that I was on came on, he was doing a whole rant about a basketball playoff game between the Boston Celtics and the Philadelphia 76ers. And without going into all the intricacies, Brent Musburger, the game was tape delayed. And Brent Musburger, right as the game was coming down to the climax, gave away the fact that the Celtics won the game since he was announcing over a tape-delayed thing. This is the kind of thing, if you're a sports fan and you're forced to watch tape-delayed broadcast, absolutely drives you nuts. And so Yoruba went into about a one-minute tirade about, what is a Musburger anyway? Is that some is that some kind of a hamburger or a cheeseburger? What is? I know what a hamburger is. I know what a cheeseburger is, but what's a Musburger? Well, a Musburger is a reactionary idiot, and so is a Bill Cosby. Now, Cosby, in his Spelman commencement speech, with bitter irony, raised the slogan, "It takes a village to raise a child," and then went on this whole rant about how, well, in that village, there are drug dealers. In that village, there are robbers. In their village, there are men who have babies and then walk away and don't care anything about what happens and leave the woman with the baby. Watch out for what's going on in that village. In other words, continuing as Michael Eric Dyson characterized it, his blame the poor attack. Now, the things that Cosby chooses to attack the masses around, and the way in which he chooses to make these attacks, what he focuses on, and what he ignores, or is ignorant of, or at least acts as if he is ignorant of, what he refuses to speak to, all this reverses cause and effect. It's not that none of the things that he mentions are there or are real. It's not that none of them have any negative consequences. It's not that none of this does harm to the masses. All of that is true. But the question is, what is all this rooted in? Where did it all come from? Is it because of some inherent flaw in the masses of people who engage in these acts, which are in fact harmful to their own interests and the interests of the broader mass of people, and in fact ultimately harmful to humanity? Is there something, some genetic deficiency, as some would argue? Or is there some cultural deficiency that's there of their own making, as others would argue? Is there some lack of character, as Bill Cosby is arguing? Or, in fact, are they responding spontaneously? Yes, not in the way that's positive, not in the way that we want them to, not in the way they objectively need to, but they're responding spontaneously to the conditions that have been imposed on them. All this talk, for example, about the breakup of the black family, besides the fact that it's an assertion of patriarchy, is completely non-materialist and once again reverses cause and effect. And does it in several ways. One, doesn't get to the underlying dynamics of what has actually led to the significant breakup of the traditional family in the inner cities. And also reverses cause and effect in putting forward the argument, either openly and explicitly or by implication, that all the poverty and oppressed conditions, or many of them, or much of that, can be attributed to the breakup of the family rather than the other way around, rather than the breakup of the family, leaving aside the question of the patriarchal character of the family, the breakup of the family is one of the results, one of the consequences of conditions of oppression that people have been subjected to and the changing forms of that oppression. In a pamphlet we put out, Cold Truth, Liberating Truth, which spoke to the whole situation and historical experience of black people and pointed to their liberation as part of the overall emancipating struggle of revolution and communism, we pointed out that it's a mischaracterization that's very commonly put forward and commonly believed that from the period of slavery up through the present time, the black family has basically not been the traditional family. This is not factually true. And if we go back to slavery, it's very interesting. All these pious people talking about the family and blaming the black masses for all the problems because supposedly they are not responsible to keep a family together. The same kind of people, the people whose political, if not literal, descendants they are, back in the days of slavery, had no compunction whatsoever about breaking up black families, even as to the degree they were allowed to be formed during slavery. They not only repeatedly and frequently sold husband and wives to different owners, they sold children out from underneath the parents. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old children repeatedly, if it was profitable for them to do so. They had absolutely no concern for the maintenance of the black family. But after the ending of slavery and during the period of semi-feudal exploitation and all the Jim Crow and KKK that went along with it, most black families, a clear majority of black families, were traditional two-parent families. And as we know, black people were doing wonderfully well during that whole period. There was no poverty. There was no oppression. There was no violence perpetrated against the people or even among themselves. There was no night-riding terror. There were no racist sheriffs hauling people off and lynching them. Oh, no, everything was wonderful because most families were traditional two-parent families. Well, my irony is obviously speaking to the reality of what was really going on. So there were overwhelmingly two-parent families, and black people were catching hell every time they turned around in this context because of the ways in which the system oppressed them at that time. And the ways in which it oppressed them at that time favored the maintenance, by and large, of two-parent families. They were largely sharecroppers working in agriculture. That kind of a situation is reinforced by and conducive to maintaining large families with two parents and many children can go out and work in the fields with a traditional and patriarchal division of labor. Then, by the dynamics of the same system, beginning after World War I, but accelerating and slowing down during the Depression, but accelerating during and after World War II, masses of black people who'd have been effectively chained to the land in the millions in the South were expelled in the millions from the land, at the same time drawn to the cities of the South, but especially of the North. The push-pull of being driven off the land and the pull of being seeking a better life. And they went into the ghettos in the North, the families intact overwhelmingly, and they would seek work, usually the men, often the women. And for a while, some were able to find jobs, and then the jobs moved away. Especially they began moving away even earlier for masses of black people than they did for others. This is the point that Thomas Sugrue makes in his book, The Origins of the Urban Crisis. The black people, the youth with their pants hanging down around their knees, with their hats on backward and their swagger, which largely I admire, were not the ones who picked the jobs up and moved them out of the ghetto. The people filling the prisons, the people in the gangs, were not the ones who took the jobs and moved them away. They were not the ones who, when black people went chasing the jobs into the suburbs where they were being relocated over the decades, discriminated against them, brought the police out to harass them, and made it very difficult for them to get a job and keep a job in those circumstances. None of that was done by the masses whom Bill Cosby cheaply chooses to attack in these ways. These were conditions that were caused by the dynamics of capitalist accumulation and its international dimension as well as within the country, and by conscious policy of the ruling class politicians in line with this. I remember back in the 60s, there was a bill introduced in the House of Representatives, the Congress, to allocate money for rat extermination in the inner cities. And the most disgusting thing was that there was a report about how these politicians were laughing uproariously at the whole idea, even while they finally allocated some money. But the whole thing was a big joke to them. You know, Stevie Wonder wrote a song, one of his lesser known, I guess, but to me one of his more powerful songs, called Village Ghetto Land. You know, would you like to go with me down my dead-end street? Would you like to go with me to Village Ghetto Land? And in this he talks about politicians drunk, laughing at all the demands of the people. This is not the gang members drunk laughing at the demands of the people. This is the ruling class, in line fundamentally and ultimately with the underlying dynamics of the capitalist and imperialist system of accumulation and exploitation. And this has continued and become more extreme since the 1960s. So many youth and others are acting spontaneously in response to conditions that they had nothing to do with creating and which have been forcibly imposed on them. And instead of calling attention to that and calling on the masses to rise up against that, Bill Cosby is blaming them and telling them, well, you can't keep using the excuse about blaming the white man. Well, okay, it's not the white man, it's the system. You might have told him that instead if you wanted to do some good. But he's not interested in doing good for the masses of the kind that they need. And along with this, perhaps ironically, what Cosby is so ardently and arrogantly preaching cannot provide the means for putting it into, but in fact can only act to help reinforce even those things for which he attacks the masses, which are harmful to the masses themselves and their most vital and fundamental interest. Cosby does not see or refuses to recognize that in the most fundamental sense, these things are not the fault of the masses, and that in reality, these negative things can be overcome. The masses can cast off these things, but only through getting to what is the real fault, the real cause, the real problem, and rooting that out and changing themselves in that process. Marx spoke of changing circumstances and changing people. That's what the Communist Revolution is about. And in one sense, any revolution is about that, but in a qualitatively greater and higher way, more fundamental way, that's what the Communist Revolution is about. It's about changing circumstances and changing people and the dialectical relation, the back and forth between changing people and changing circumstances. But in that overall relationship, while people can and must take conscious initiative to change their circumstances, it is only through changing the circumstances as the main thing that people can radically change themselves as well. And this is what Cosby is ignorant of or is consciously ignoring and, in fact, pointing away from. Now let's look at how Bill Clinton put out the same line and argued for the same line and attacked the masses with the same line. At the start of his administration, he used the proverbial bully pulpit of the presidency to attack the masses of black people in the inner cities with the same theme as Bill Cosby. One of the things we should understand, by the way, as a backdrop to this, is that since the 60s in particular, there has been significant polarization among black people through the whole civil rights, but more than the civil rights, what's also written out of the mainstream history, a revolutionary movement that developed among black people and spread its influence broadly in society. In the face of that, responding to that, largely through conscious policy of the ruling class, including through things like affirmative action, without which clowns like Clarence Thomas would not be where he is while he denounces affirmative action, there was a stimulation of the growth of a significant black middle class well beyond what had existed previously. Sometimes the relationship between the upsurge in the masses and the concessions made was rather immediate and glaring. For example, the largest scale rebellion in terms of a single city during the 60s was in Detroit. It lasted the longest, it was the most ferocious in a positive sense, and had the largest impact, and it drew the largest and most vicious repression from the ruling class, sending in the army under Lyndon Johnson, Mr. Great Society. And let's tell the whole truth here. A number of black leaders, or as they were called at the time, responsible Negro leaders, including Martin Luther King, called on Lyndon Johnson to send in the army to restore order, with the resulting deaths of large numbers of black people, as well as massive arrests. There was a whole scene that occurred in this context at the infamous Algiers Motel outside of Detroit, where black people who were involved in this rebellion were taken by the National Guard and the police to this motel and executed. But on the other hand, you have the hangman and the priest, you have the carrot and the stick. Instantly, in the aftermath of that rebellion, all of a sudden, the Detroit auto executives found they had thousands of jobs for black people. 5,000 jobs or so were made available immediately in the aftermath of the rebellion. So just even on shorter term considerations, it's completely wrong to argue that these rebellions never do any good. They don't in themselves change the whole character of the system, and the oppression has continued and deepened and taken on new forms as well as old ones since then. But as a result of this, there was a stimulation of a black middle class, and this is why Dyson is posing the question, or has the black middle class lost its mind? Has it forgotten the whole history of oppression? Has it forgotten even what it's subjected to, even with its middle class position, if it's driving while black or discriminated against on the job or passed over and insulted, you know, and still getting on an elevator, even dressed respectably and having other people clutch their purses or moving to the other side of the elevator and looking nervously at the entire time they're riding in the elevator. But this polarization has provided more of an audience, if you will, for the Bill Cosbys and the Bill Clintons. So Clinton, using this proverbial bully pulpit of the presidency, attacked the masses of black people in inner cities with the same theme as Bill Cosby's been doing. And this stands out sharply in an address that Clinton gave from a literal pulpit at the Memphis Church of Christ on November 13, 1993. This is a church where Martin Luther King gave his last speech before he was killed. Throughout this speech, Clinton invokes religious terms, and he sets the tone early by declaring, quote, "By the grace of God and your help, last year I was elected president of this great country." Now, there are a lot of Christian fascists who would deny the first part of that statement. But he made a point of emphasizing this, casting this immediately in religious terms, "by the grace of God and your help." Then, after speaking somewhat to the aims of his presidency and boasting of certain achievements he'd already been able to bring about, he takes up about half of this speech with a message that's captured in the following passages from this speech. He starts out like this on this theme. If Martin Luther King, who said, like Moses, I am on the mountaintop, and I can see the promised land, but I'm not going to be able to get there with you, but we will get there. If he were to reappear by my side today, said Clinton, and give us a report card on the last 25 years, what would he say? You did a good job, he would say, voting and electing people who formerly were not electable because of the color of their skin. You have more political power, and that is good. You did a good job, he would say, letting people who have the ability to do so live wherever they want to live. Oh, yeah? Go wherever they want to go in this great country, says Clinton. And here I have to interject. Has Clinton actually never heard of driving while black and everything that is bound up with all this, all the abuse, the danger of being brutalized and even killed at the whim of racist police? And as I've been emphasizing, even for middle class and relatively well-off black people? But Clinton goes on. You did a good job, he, referring to King, would say, elevating people of color into the ranks of the United States Armed Forces, to the very top, or into the very top of our government. You did a good job creating a black middle class of people who really are doing well, and the middle class is growing more among African Americans than among non-African Americans. You did a good job. You did a good job in opening opportunity. But, he would say, I did not live and die to see the American family destroyed. I did not live and die to see 13-year-old boys get automatic weapons and gun down 9-year-olds just for the kick of it. I did not live and die to see young people destroy their own lives with drugs and then build fortunes destroying the lives of others. That is not what I came here to do. I fought for freedom, he would say, Clinton goes on, referring to King. But not for the freedom of people to kill each other with reckless abandon. Not for the freedom of children to have children and the fathers of the children walk away from them and abandon them as if they don't amount to anything. I fought for people to have the right to work, but not to have whole communities and people abandoned. This is not what I lived and died for. And here we should note that this somewhat vague reference to whole communities and people being abandoned is one of very few references by Clinton in this speech to factors that he does not allege or implied are caused by the masses of black people themselves, especially those in the inner city. But then Clinton goes on with his main theme. My fellow Americans, he, that is King, would say, I fought to stop white people from being so filled with hate that they would wreak violence on black people. I did not fight for the right of black people to murder other black people with reckless abandon. Now, leaving aside what Martin Luther King might have said, it is clear that Clinton himself is trumpeting that old trite and worse than trite refrain that black people won or were given their freedom, and ever since they've been misusing it. Well, first of all, and fundamentally, through the civil rights movement, and as I've referred to it, but is often buried in the history accounts, the more powerful black liberation struggles of the 1960s and into the early 1970s, through all this, black people did shake up the whole country in a very powerful and very positive way. They did win broad support as a result from many different strata of the people. And they did wrench significant concessions from the ruling class, which has a lot to do with the changes Clinton is referring to, including the stimulation of the black middle class. But with all that, black people have not yet won their freedom. There is not yet an end to the whole horrific oppression to which black people continue to be subjected, and which has been and remains an integral and indispensable part of this system, built into its very foundations, structures, and institutions. And in fact, that oppression can only be finally and fully ended with the overthrow of this system and the advance to a whole new world. And that is the essential reason why some of the things that Clinton speaks to continue such as black youth killing each other in large numbers. This is, in fact, part of the continuing horror of black people's experience in America, in fundamental terms imposed upon them by the same system that has oppressed and enslaved and exploited them from the beginning. But what Clinton will not and cannot recognize and admit is that all this, even the things he so arrogantly denounces, is rooted in the fundamental nature and dynamics of the very system over which he was an administrative head for a number of years. So while he makes a few token references to economic and social conditions, Clinton repeatedly returns to his theme of blaming and attacking the masses of oppressed black people for their own conditions and for abusing the freedom that, according to Clinton, they have won, the freedom to succeed, as he puts it in one part of his speech. And before long, he openly bares his fangs, emphasizing in explicit terms the need for greater repression, as embodied, for example, in an anti-crime bill he was pushing to put another 100,000 police on the street. And he goes on in the same speech to say, "We cannot, I submit to you, repair the American community and restore the American family until we provide the structure, the values, the discipline, and the reward that work gives." And then, guess what? He invokes Bill Cosby and quotes a speaker at a lecture series funded by Bill and Camille Cosby, who said in that lecture series, quote, "I grew up in Anacostia years ago. Even then it was all black, and it was the very poor neighborhood. But you know, when I was a child in Anacostia, 100% African-American neighborhood, a very poor neighborhood, we had a crime rate that was lower than the average of the crime rate of our city. Why? Because we had coherent families. We had coherent communities. The people who filled the church on Sunday lived in the same place they went to church. The guy who owned the drugstore lived down the street. The person that owned the grocery store lived in our community. We were whole." Now, on a basic level, to respond to this, let me begin by saying, no, the whole that communities like that were and are actually involved in is a whole lot of trouble, a whole lot of oppression and misery, not of their own making, but as part of the basic character and functioning of this system. And look at these communities, and what is the unemployment rate now, and who caused that unemployment? The masses of black people with their unwillingness to work, or the capitalist system with its dynamics of accumulation? And it must be pointed out how this kind of rewriting of history and of reality, this romanticizing of the ghetto communities and of the life of the masses of people forcibly segregated in these ghettos a few decades ago, goes hand in hand with blaming the masses of black people still trapped in these inner city neighborhoods, blaming them for their own situation and their oppressed conditions, while segregation continues unabated, and at the same time jobs are massively pulled out of these areas, and youth especially are faced with the prospect of never being able to get a decent job, or any job at all, at least in the regular economy, while social services, including things like health care as well as education, are slashed and gutted for people in this situation through the conscious policy of the ruling class. And even the fragmenting of these ghetto communities, as referred to by the speaker from Anacostia, whom Clinton quotes, even the closing down of things like black-owned stores, is the result of the workings of this system, both the actual dynamics of the capitalist economy and who dominates it, and the policies, once again, of the ruling class. All of which has promoted a situation where black middle-class elements have moved away from the inner-city ghettos in large numbers, and those left behind are left to rot and confined in a situation where many things conspire to encourage them to prey on and turn violently on each other. As I have pointed out before, if even a conservative analyst like Edward Luttwak can say that for millions and millions of youth in the inner city, crime is now a rational choice, then what kind of fucking system have we got? And if Luttwak understands and can speak to this, what excuse can there be for Bill Clinton and Bill Cosby for not knowing this or pretending not to know it? So, as a basic point of orientation, I will repeat what I have said about this before. Fuck Bill Cosby. And fuck Bill Clinton and his sermonizing about this too. But let's go further. Proceeding from this orientation and a real understanding of the fundamental realities and dynamics involved, let's look at the larger implications of what is raised in these attacks made by people posturing as friends of the black masses, pretending to administer to these masses much-needed tough love. Let's dig down more deeply to the fundamental questions that are actually involved in all this. Here again comes in the theme, the incessant theme, the everywhere repeated and drummed theme of personal responsibility. Now, the first and basic thing that must be said about this whole theme of personal responsibility, along with the fact that it's a weapon attacking the masses of people and blaming them from their own conditions, is that fundamentally it's a deliberate attempt to evade and direct attention away from social reality and social responsibility. If you can blame the masses themselves for not taking the necessary responsibility to change their circumstances and their behavior, then you are like a magician or like someone doing three-card Monty. You're directing attention away from what's really going on. What are the real underlying and causal dynamics, the social reality in which this behavior takes place, and which in a fundamental sense gives rise to the impetus toward this behavior, and the social responsibility, the responsibility that the society has, and more specifically the responsibility that lies with the system for creating these conditions and these dynamics that push people in this direction. Once again, we come back to the basic question here. What has caused, to use Clinton's language, whole communities and people to be abandoned? Did the people abandon themselves? Did they, through their behavior, somehow turn their backs on themselves? Did they all get up one day and say, well, we've been working for a while, let's all fire ourselves? Let's move these places we've been working and close them down, tear them down, turn them into concrete and rubble, and go exploit somebody in Indonesia instead? I mean, the answer to these questions, these are questions that answer themselves. But the answer needs to be emphasized in the face of this unrelenting assault, ideological assault on the masses of people, particularly those at the base of society, among the lower and deeper sections of the proletariat and other impoverished and oppressed masses. In order to evade the responsibility and deflect attention from the responsibility of the system, and in order to get the masses themselves who are in these conditions and people of other strata to blame them. In the talk, Why We're in the Situation We're in Today and What to Do About It, A Thoroughly Rotten System and the Need for Revolution, I spoke to how we got in the situation we're in today, including how the masses in the inner cities got to the situation that they're in today. And this is what is being systematically and deliberately evaded, and from which attention is being systematically and deliberately deflected. As an ideological weapon which goes along with the whole political and social program of, on the one hand, undermining even further the basic conditions of the masses, gutting the health care, the educational system, the housing and so on, as well as the employment, and then bringing down repression in an even more intensive and extensive way, even with its genocidal implications, as I've spoken to elsewhere, as the program for dealing with this. And this personal responsibility is the ideological part of this arsenal, of this whole social and political program, even with its genocidal implications. Now, in preaching from a pulpit of bones, particularly in the first essay, discussing and dissecting the real content and meaning of the virtues promoted by William Bennett, I emphasize the point that these kind of reactionaries like Bennett, and also liberals, paternalistic friends of the masses like Bill Clinton as well as Bill Cosby, are always talking about choices. You have choices. You made choices. Yes, you're in these conditions, but you chose to do this or that. This is what Cosby's been hammering at, and it's the point Clinton is making. And the point that I emphasize in preaching from a pulpit of bones is that in a fundamental sense, choices are socially, and in today's world more than ever, internationally determined. And I gave some examples. Why is it that a family in Thailand has the choice of selling their daughter to a brothel at age 9 or 10 to be sexually exploited by soldiers and businessmen from imperialist countries and the ruling classes around the world who come to Thailand for sexual vacations, or selling her into a factory, in effect, where she can be exploited under the most merciless conditions, beginning at the same age, 9 or 10, making consumer items or other goods consumed by people in the imperialist countries? Why is that the choice they have if the rest of the family even has a chance of surviving? William Bennett doesn't face that choice. Is that because William Bennett's character is better than the masses of people in Thailand who are being driven off their land by the same workings of the system that Bennett is one of the people presiding over and apologizing for and defending and attacking the masses in so doing? Why does a William Bennett on the other side of the equation and the class he represents, why are their choices, which they might discuss at $10,000 a plate events, whether to wage war first against the Palestinian people or first against Iraq or when to go to war with Iran or what to do about attacking or threatening North Korea or whether to move a factory out of Thailand and over to Vietnam to be able to exploit people more profitably, or whether and how to exploit more effectively the people in Haiti rather than in Pakistan? Why doesn't a 9-year-old girl in Thailand discuss choices like that? While William Bennett and his class, these are the choices they discuss and make all the time with devastating consequences for that 9-year-old girl in Thailand and her family and millions and millions and millions of people like them. Or even if you're in the middle class in the U.S., why is your choice not having your kids go to college or going deeply in debt in order to send them to college? Why do people in the middle class face those choices and William Bennett in the ruling class does not face that choice? Is that because William Bennett and others like him have more virtues? Their character is somehow better? Or, getting back to the subject we're focusing on here, why do the people in the inner cities, why do the youth in the inner cities face the choice of maybe getting a job at McDonald's, which is going nowhere and which may not last, or selling drugs, or working as a runner or a lookout for a drug dealer? Why are those the choices that they can choose among? Why can they choose to do that or go to prison? Why does that the way choices, quote unquote, present themselves to them? Evade the police, not get caught or go to prison, or get shot and killed either by the police or by one of the rivals in the drug trade. Get rich or die trying, but most are going to die a lot more than they're going to get rich. And even those who get rich often die. It's not long lasting. But why are those the choices people are presented with? What? Is it a lottery? You know, everybody reaches into some gigantic hat somewhere and you pull out a piece of paper and it gives you a couple of choices? Or is there something much more fundamental going on here? Or is there dynamics of a system which is historically established and rooted and has a superstructure of politics and armed force as well as ideology being purveyed and pumped out everywhere by the likes of Clinton and Bill Cosby as well as the likes of George Bush and William Bennett? Is that why these choices present themselves differently to different people in the world? Why did Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs have the choice of fucking around like the rest of their friends or going in their garage as young men and playing around with computer stuff? How come, as I pointed out before, someone their age in their early 20s in Pakistan or in Egypt or in Turkey or in El Salvador was either on the street scrambling to try to live or else had already been working for 10 years, 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, under the domination of imperialist capital, working for international corporations in almost unimaginably exploitative conditions? What explains that difference and the choices that people in those different positions have? What choice does a 5-year-old kid in India working to make matches, what choice do they have about their conditions as long as they're within the confines of this system? So to preach to the masses about choices when choices are presented to them in this way is not only adding insult to tremendous injury, but is an ideological assault which is part of and aimed to reinforce the overall assault on these masses and the overall workings of the system which is cast and is determined to keep these masses in these conditions, whether in the inner cities of the U.S. or in the slums of Jakarta. Choices are socially and internationally determined, and not in some abstract sense, but by the underlying dynamics of the system and by the actions of the rulers of the system through the superstructure, including political decision-making and, yes, armed force on a massively destructive scale. That's how choices get molded and determined and presented to masses of people throughout the world where they haven't broken through and thrown the system off. So just as I pointed out in Views on Socialism and Communism, wants and needs are socially determined, so are choices that people make. And the range of choices within which they can choose. Now, is there a need for people, including the masses of people in the lower, deeper sections of the proletariat, and other oppressed and impoverished masses? Is there a need for those, for that matter, in all strata among the people to change themselves? How they think and act in very significant ways? Yes, definitely and emphatically there is a need for that. It's cheap and easy to attack, as Clinton and Cosby and others do, the masses of people, for some of the obvious ways in which they are acting against their own interests. But once again, the real question is, how are they going to, in any fundamental and lasting sense, change the way they think and act? Can people choose to change their circumstances? Yes. But here we have to immediately add some things. One, they can do so in any really significant and positive and lasting way if and as they become aware of and understand, at least in basic and essential terms, what is the cause of those circumstances, why they are in the situation they are in, and how they are being impelled by those circumstances to act, and the choices that are being presented to them. Two, they can only do so by proceeding from the actual causes and dynamics of their situation and its larger context, and by changing their conditions accordingly. In other words, by correctly understanding and on that basis radically transforming the objective reality and its driving and determining causes. Or, to put it another way, consciously transforming the necessity they face and wrenching freedom out of that. And three, in any fundamental sense, it is only in the context and the course of doing this that people can also change themselves, their thinking and their actions in any qualitative, fundamental, and lasting way, and that they can and must change themselves in dialectical relation to, in a back-and-forth interaction and interplay with, changing the larger objective reality they are confronted with and changing themselves back and forth with that. Changing circumstances and changing people in dialectical relation with the primary emphasis on changing the circumstances. Because only if the circumstances are fundamentally and qualitatively transformed, and only in the course and through the process of fundamentally transforming the objective circumstances, can people radically transform themselves in their thinking and their actions. So then, what is, as we've seen, the social role of rationalizations and more than rationalization, weapons of ideological assault like personal responsibility? Among them are casting or deflecting the blame for the conditions of oppressed people back on themselves, in their own minds, but also significantly in the minds of people in other strata in society. So that others look at them and say, well, that must be their own fault. So I don't have to worry about that. They should just change their behavior. Look, even Bill Cosby, he was one of them too. He grew up in a housing project, and he says it's their own fault, so I don't have to worry about that. And even more fundamentally, how could I ever think that people like that could lead a struggle that would lead to a far better society when clearly they're all fucked up and it's their own fault? So these are important ideological purposes that are served by this trumpeting and wielding of this weapon of personal responsibility. And as I pointed out, it is also a means of evading, at the same time, social responsibility and the responsibility of the system, and therefore pointing people toward the need to abolish the system. And I've referred in other contexts to The Bell Curve, the book that came out in the 1990s, which attempted to provide, quote-unquote, scientific justification for the notion that some people, in particular people of African origin, but others as well, were inferior to others, in particular people of European and some Asian origins. To root this in, and to root the inequalities that exist in society, in genetic and other unchangeable characteristics. Now, as openly reactionary as this was, and as readily refuted as the so-called science was, this was promoted because it went along with the agenda that I've been speaking of, slashing social programs, intensifying repression against the masses in the context of the needs and dynamics of the system of the time and continuing to today. But what we should recognize here, and what's relevant particularly here, is that things like the bell curve are in reality, with all their fraudulent so-called science and actual pseudoscience, and with all their openly reactionary aims and purposes, they are in reality the companion and are mutually reinforcing with rants by those of Bill Cosby and similar scoldings by Bill Clinton, even if Clinton and Cosby might say that they disagree with the arguments of the bell curve. And speaking specifically of Clinton, but not Clinton alone, in his book Nixon's Piano, Kenneth O'Reilly surveys the history of the U.S. and speaks to and analyzes and shows vividly how every president throughout the history of the U.S., up through Clinton — Clinton was still in office when he wrote the book — every president of the U.S. up through Clinton has catered to and promoted white supremacy, including Kennedy and Johnson, and yes, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. He points to just a few examples that I'll just briefly mention here, but I'm just going to point to a few examples that he mentions, but he analyzes it more fully in the book Nixon's Piano. There was a whole episode that arose when Clinton, during the time he was contesting for president, chose to launch a whole attack on a frankly not that significant figure, Sister Soldier, and went into a whole rant about her and, you know, how she was promoting bad values. And he made a point in connection with that and more generally of distancing himself even from Jesse Jackson in order to better appeal to white supremacist sentiments. And as things went on, he undermined even some of his own nominees for government positions like Lanny Guinier when some of her more progressive statements came out. He not only retreated and abandoned her, but he undermined her. And most strikingly and disgustingly, the example that really stands out that O'Reilly cites in Nixon's Piano is Clinton promoting chain gangs in prison in the South, putting a black chain gang, a black prison chain gang, in an anti-crime ad in his 1992 campaign for president. Now, nobody who knows about the history of the South and of this country overall could possibly miss the symbolism of that. And not being able to miss that symbolism definitely includes Bill Clinton, who, whatever else he is not an idiot and is not unaware, and who obviously did this as a means of consciously invoking that very symbolism of chain gangs and, yes, the suggestion of slavery. That's the end of the first section of this talk.